Welcome, welcome, everyone. This is Eurofile stepping in for Kremlin File. And as usual, here's Scott. Hi, Scott.
Hey, Monique, how you doing?
Kremlin File will be back in September. This is Eurofile Scott Lucas or Olga Lautman. Scott and I will be developing Eurofile much more, let's say, in the fall. So stick with us. Our special guest that we're going to have, Marley Clemens. She's a documentary filmmaker, and she focuses mainly on issues of disinformation and hybrid warfare. She's the co-creator and the host of the Vice documentary series, QAnon, The Search for Q. And series 2 is coming up, which we're going to be talking about. So without any further ado, let's welcome Marley Clemens to the pod. Hi, Marley.
Hi, guys. So good to be here.
Marley, let me just start off with a little personal story, okay, just to get us going. And I ran into, I'll just say that I found out about QAnon through a friend of mine in Canada. I was doing a lot of research on Trump and all of the people that were surrounding him. Okay. Mm-hmm. And this was, I can tell you, 2018, around that time, the spring, May, that kind of, you know, that period.
Very popular for Q.
Yeah. And indeed, one of my friends, so I mean, she's not into this stuff, but she knew I was doing research. And she said, Monique, have you seen this video? And she sent me a link to it. And I think it was either called In the Shadows or In the Storm or something like that. Mm-hmm. Okay. And the narration was done by this Dutch woman. Mm-hmm. The video itself was the most disturbing, fucked up thing I'd ever seen in my entire life. Okay. Yeah. And I sat there and I watched, I really even couldn't watch it. I'd like all in one go. I had to stop and move on. There were pictures that were all of the images, the stills, all that kind of thing were highly, highly disturbing. I mean, truly disturbing. That's why I had to stop, mm-hmm. Half the time. And it was being pushed at that time by a guy on YouTube, if I'm not mistaken. And I started digging and digging. And that's where I found Vice, okay, as well, because Vice had already done like a few explainers or mm-hmm. different things on Q. So that's what I was using as my background. But I want you now, okay, to tell us a little bit about it. 2018, you said that that's when it took off, right?
Yeah, I'd say that's when it really mainstreamed. It was first, the first post, the first drop, as they call them, came out in October 2017. It was mm-hmm. right about the time that the Mueller investigation was really heating up, coincidentally or not so much so. And so it came about then, the drop started then, but they continued through December 2020. So it went on for about 4 years, 3 or 4 years. And was really able to, through videos like what you're talking about, video was really highly important to it taking off. And one of that video specifically you're talking about, I think I see as one of the most radicalizing agents of QAnon, right?
Yeah. What is in that video that radicalizes? Like, how do they, what did they use?
It's hypnotic. It's certainly a use of hypnotic imagery. I think it's sort of, filmmaking, movie magic, propaganda 101 type of cuts. And that woman's voice is super hypnotic. Oh. And
She's repetitive.
Yes. Keep saying it. Yeah. Putting these disturbing images on that are gonna really, throw you off balance and really like screw with your equilibrium and your mental state. And it was able to bring in millions of people. And season one, we talked to, it was a 3-part series and we looked at the who, what, and why behind QAnon. And I can't tell you how many people we interviewed that said, well, I got into this through Fall of the Cabal, which is that film. And it was an 8-part series and they kept it going and they really felt like they needed to latch onto it and keep going. And they each video gets deeper and deeper and darker and darker. And it really worked. People were stuck at home during the pandemic. And I think that's when it like really, really hit there.
Yeah.
Marley, can you give me a sense of timeline here? In that you say they dropped the video in 2017. So towards the back of 17.
Yeah. So this is actually when just to clarify the drops themselves, which is mm-hmm. what how QAnon communicates to his followers or sort mm-hmm. of these I mean, I think they'd like me to say cryptic, but they're really not that cryptic. They're really poorly written, sort of just choppy, like weird little tip things.
Yeah. But I mean, back in, you know, the themes of QAnon, including the themes of pedophilia and the corrupt elites, of course, they're there in the 2016 election with, for example, the Pizzagate deception, Pizzagate lie that's being spread and so on. Is QAnon actually functioning at that time in 2016, just not in as highly organized a fashion as when they do the drops? Or are they simply drawing from others, like, for example, well, I won't give names here for legal reasons at this point, but from others who are promoting the Pizzagate?
Deception. I think that it was, I think I see Pizzagate as sort of a precursor to QAnon. Okay. There's certainly a lot of overlap with the figures involved with it. And I think that they saw how well that worked. And actually prior to QAnon, there was FBI and on CIA and on, and those were these groups in, you know, Reddit and 8chan, 4chan specifically, that were really pushing many of the same narratives that eventually became core to Q.
So if you can help me out with like the connections that you're making that you've had to live with. I mean, when you talk about people like Jack Posobiec and Mike Cernovich who are involved in promoting the Pizzagate and other scandals in 2016, are there active links between those involved in the 2016? Or is it QAnon just simply, as it were, a network that draws from the themes that are already out there for its own purposes?
No, I see them as very active links. I think it's in most of the same actors. I think they pick new guys up along the way, right? But I think that it is the same group of bad actors, a lot of connections to Russia, who come together and say, all right, well, this worked really well. This information warfare worked so well in 2016. Let's draw on those themes and those same tactics, the same techniques and procedures to continue to radicalize people and get them to a place where they will not believe mainstream news. They won't believe what happens in Mueller's report. They won't believe anything that the president, you know, Trump was doing that was absolutely crazy. All they have to believe is that he is saving the world from these pedophiles. Yeah. Right. And so nothing else matters at that point. So it is many of the same actors, and they do pick up, they saw Pizzagate and many of the other disinformation campaigns in 2016. It's just so effective that they were like, let's run with this.
Wow. Well, how far back can we pull the links? I mean, you know, you've got InfoWars, Alex Jones back in the news right now. Yeah, you've got Prison Planet with Paul Joseph Watson. You know, again, is it a sense that these folks, we think of QAnon as being distinct, but in a sense, are they not only drawing from those predecessors, but in fact, there's a wider network here. It's just that QAnon, as it were, you know, sort of outdoes everybody else in terms of the deep dark mystique that's associated with it.
Yeah, no, I think it's definitely does, you know, build on the tradition of Alex Jones. Alex Jones is very, he's integral in the original, as QAnon is forming, he's pushing it out. Alex Jones has at some point a split with Q. There's a lot of back and forth there with figures like Jack Posobiec and Alex Jones specifically, who are like, well, maybe this has gone too far, and then maybe it hasn't, and they're kind of in and out. And I think that's probably, you know, they got cut off and they weren't getting the money, and they saw it was taking off, right?
Oh, wow.
Probably. But certainly at the beginning, they were seen as very much like validators of these theories and pushing people to the boards where they would see this. So it was many of the same communities that were already paying attention to Alex Jones. And then they just were really latched on there and were like, oh, this is the new Alex Jones. But I think the thing that QAnon did that really surpasses any of these people is that there wasn't a figure there. You didn't have to look at Alex Jones. You didn't have to. There was no personality to attach it to. You couldn't do oppo on this person. There was nothing that you could to do to discredit them because there was no real person.
Wow. What are the theories of the origins? Like, I'm sure that this is something that you've gone through, right? In the series. And are there basic theories? Like, are there certain people that you feel were the originators, or did it develop and sort of like different groups took on different aspects of the conspiracy theories?
I see it as both. I see very much that there is the originators here. The earliest people we can point to are this sort of group of internet trolls, people like Microchip, Jack Posobiec is in the mix there. And there's a gentleman, not a gentleman, there's an internet troll named Manny Chavez DeFango, who we interviewed in season one, who claims he came up with it. I believe that it was really, you know, it might have started with these internet trolls, but I don't see that this is an idea that they had. And a lot of the pieces that have come out about QAnon do focus on the actors behind it themselves. They look at, there's a group called Patriot Soapbox that were really the first big aggregators of Q, a woman in that, Tracy Beans. And to your point of earlier, I mean, she goes back in these networks for a decade, right? She was a big Rand Paul activist in 09, right? Who really linked into these groups. So there's certainly, you can look at the drops themselves and you do see that they are handed off between people, between groups. But I believe, and what our investigation has shown and what we focus on our show that's different than most pieces is, regardless of who's typing it, right, who's putting these out, there's plenty of, all companies have, you know, social media managers. I almost see the person who was posting themselves as something more like that. But we really focus on, you know, what are the goals here and who are sort of the big people, you know, pulling the strings behind the screen door or whatever. And so we really do land on that this, you know, Q claims to be a military intelligence operation that is, you know, stopping the deep state from killing your kids and Donald Trump or whatever. And what we see is that, you know, with, at risk of, you know, giving credit to QAnon, I do see it as military intelligence tactics. And for us, we did not anticipate immediately investigating this element of it, but everywhere we went, everything that we did, all of our investigations, just every rabbit hole landed on Mike Flynn. And so we really focus, in on Flynn, who's seen as this hero in the QAnon movement. And they consider themselves digital soldiers in his army. And so I've spent several years now really deeply, deeply focusing on Mike Flynn and his connections to QAnon. And there's, I mean, they're endless.
Wow. Go ahead, Scott.
Can I tease that out? Because that's, you know, that's a headline claim. It deserves to be. But when we say, like, okay, is it the sense that QAnon is drawing inspiration from Mike Flynn? Is it that Mike Flynn is sort of dog whistling with certain lines that he knows that QAnon will pick up? Or does it go beyond that in that there's actually communication between some of the key activists in QAnon with those around Mike Flynn, that there's some type of discussion and coordination of attack lines, as it were?
I think that it's all of the above. We certainly see him interacting very closely with the group I mentioned, Patriot Soapbox and Tracy Beans. For example, he and Tracy have several entities formed together. There is a, there's a money trail. You know, he attempted to trademark the phrase digital soldiers, which we talk about this season, which is the phrase that they, the, what they used to call themselves. And so they are, you know, he's selling t-shirts. He's definitely making money off of this. They're hugely supportive of the Mike Flynn Defense Fund. There's a deep paper trail, as well as, you know, a lot of dog whistle stuff, but also just some straight whistling, just whistle a Dixie straight to them, like air horde, big, you know, like signs on, during the period that PQ was posting on the board from 17 to, or 18 to 2020, he's signing his autographs, you know, WWG1, WGA, which is a QAnon slogan and how Q signs off the drops. He is very, very, you know, while does not take credit for it publicly, is very, very active in both the myth of QAnon and the belief, what the believers think that they are doing. They, I mean, they're the ones who really led me to him, right? They really were like, it's Flynn, it's gotta be Flynn. And like, look, I, as soon as I posted this, he followed me back on Twitter and he did this. And it's so much of that where you're like, wait, what? Like, why would a, you know, retired three-star general do that? Even even a crazy one, right? And so and so it's definitely, he plays into it in a very serious way. And then there's also, yeah, pretty serious paper trail and just connections with all of the big influencers in Q and the Flynn team.
Okay, so two things, Marley. One, if you could tell us a little bit about Flynn's background. I mean, we know his background. There may be people who are listening and watching that don't know anything about him and why he would be so like the person, okay, that that they look.
Yeah,
and
sure.
Also, you know, how why well, the connection with Flynn and QAnon when you know his background. So I'd like you to ask, you know, comment, okay, on that.
Yeah, for sure. Just
a little bit about that. And then I want to get in a little bit to connections with Russia, because I think that's an important part of this as well. So let's start with Flynn.
Yeah, sure. So Flynn is a military intelligence, army intelligence guy. He was really a big part of, he's one of our top intelligence officers in Iraq and then Afghanistan. He was the head of military intelligence in Afghanistan for many years. He wrote a report that he became very famous for on where, how we were failing in our intelligence. And in rereading that report recently, I read it, I've read it several times throughout various projects of mine, but rereading it recently, it really stands out to me that many of the tactics that he's talking about that he needs to, we need to be undertaking as a country in Afghanistan, the U.S. military should be undertaking there are what we see here. You know, it really is about this, these psychological operations and getting information in front of people and siloing information systems and also getting out into the field and going into places that we normally wouldn't and not just being there, you know, as soldiers, but going into communities, helping get schools started. He talks a lot in this report about, you know, it's great that we go around and build these schools, but then we let them pick their own teachers. Well, we need to be, you know, controlling education and putting teachers in there and things. And we need to, you know, get out from behind our big tanks and our sunglasses and go into these villages, meet with tribal leaders, meet with clerics, and build relationships there so that we are able to get our message more directly to the communities that in Afghanistan. And so we see that very, very, that is QAnon, right? That is exactly what they do.
Yeah.
But Flynn goes on after Afghanistan to become the head of the DIA, the Defense Intelligence Agency, under President Obama. And he has several years there. He's eventually fired. There's a lot of back and forth about what it is that he's fired about, a lot of different claims on that. But he becomes immediately very disgruntled, very, very upset with the U.S. government, says that the only reason he was fired is because, you know, Obama's protecting ISIS and that he was the only one who was going to deal with ISIS properly and things like that, like really crazy claims. And he becomes wildly Islamophobic and conspiratorial. People that were close to him at the time just started kind of being like, wait, what are you talking about, man? Like, it got really weird. Dinners got weird. Lunches got weird. He started losing friends. And then very shortly after 2014, he starts sort of turning up in Moscow. He has a relationship with a woman, Svetlana Lakova. He meets at a Cambridge seminar. And, you know, the nature of their relationship, I can't speak to, but it certainly does, you know, they are emailing back and forth for years. And he's signing the emails, General Misha, and he becomes very close with her.
Wow.
He was the first U.S. intelligence official in our history to be given a tour of the GRU. So that was a pretty big one and that really set off a lot of alarms in the US intelligence community. And then when Donald Trump comes on the scene, he shows up as an advisor and famously gives a speech at the RNC calling for Hillary Clinton to be locked up. He's really who got the lock her up language really kicked off, and then becomes President Trump's first national security advisor, which is a terrifying position for the country was in during the brief period that he did do that. That was only 21 days he was the national security advisor, but he was fired for lying about his conversations with the Russian ambassador as it related to kicking out a bunch of Russian diplomats. And so he was lying about that. He was clearly continually having a relationship with the Kremlin and lying to everybody about it. And it was one of the big things that kicked off the Mueller investigation.
Wow.
I mean, that's
that's a lot. Is that, no, is that too much?
Well, it's vital.
Perfect.
Like, vital.
Perfect. You know, it is vital. People need to understand this. Yeah.
Hi, everybody. I'm Katie Segal.
And I'm Kurt Sutter.
And welcome to our new podcast called Pi, People, Influences, and Experiences.
Yes, it's sort of the get to know you at a deeper level, the who, what, when, where, and why you are, rather than what it is you do.
Absolutely. We're not going to talk too much about what people do. We just want to know about their families, where they come from, you know, what shapes their parenting if they have kids, what shapes their marriages if they're married. We just want to be really nosy. We want to get in there.
A deep dive into nature and nurture.
And we started it because there are a lot of people that we don't know that we are curious about.
Right. And I have no friends. So for me, it's, you know.
Trying to get them out of the house.
Listen to it on whatever you listen to podcasts on.
Yeah, podcast, homecast.
Your podcasting apparatus. Watch it on the YouTube.
He's aging himself.
Just to really pull everything together then. So, of course, Flynn is dismissed on Valentine's Day, 2017, yeah. After 3 weeks in there. At what point do the connections begin with QAnon? Are you able to track it down when they start first communicating with each other or dog whistling each other?
So pretty much immediately after he's fired, you start seeing him interact with a lot of the groups that later become very core to Q. Q is not posted yet. There is no Q at this point, but you start seeing him sort of interacting with these groups. He also forms several entities that are very Q sounding, right? He's got Resilient Patriot is his first entity that he forms after leaving the White House. And things sort of just pick up from there. And as the Mueller investigation really kicks off, you know, he has serious legal issues, and these lawyers are super expensive. He has to sell his house in Alexandria, in order to pay for them. And I think that, you know, around the time that the Mike Flynn Defense Fund is created by his family and starts to be pushed, you see the earliest rumblings of Q really kick off. And so this sort of coincide pretty exactly in terms of timing. There's a great piece I would direct your viewers to read in The Intercept, written by a wonderful reporter, Candace Rondeau, who does really, really important work for democracy. And her piece on Mike Flynn's connections to QAnon and Intercept, I think, is the most thorough written piece, of course, watched QAnon Search for Q. We really cover quite a bit. We do cover a lot of this, and we interview Candace. It was really great to get to sit with her. And she's wonderful because she was a war reporter for the war correspondent for the Washington Post. And she was able to, she spent a lot of time with Mike Flynn in Afghanistan, which is really what prompted this, was that this was this general that she respected and had, you know, good working relationship with in those years, and watching him devolve into the Q general, right? This wild conspiracy theory peddling guy who's just all memes of Mike Flynn all the time from the Q crowd, I think really sparked her. And so we've had some fascinating conversations between our research together. She's great.
Yeah. So, we'll make sure to put the link, okay, when we put up the episode. Yeah.
So are you able to, Marley, able to establish the motives here for Flynn? I mean, clearly one motive might just simply be financial, that you tap into and use QAnon to keep himself above water during all the legal.
Yeah, it's a big one.
Is it to provide cover for Trump, even though Flynn is no longer in the White House, through a whole sense of information operations? Or is Flynn actually looking at some type of different American system, some type of different, as it were, change to the system, mobilizing Q in some way to do that?
I think it's all of the above, unfortunately. I do think that there's definitely connection to, he's a grifter, and he's definitely grifted off of the Q world, Q community, rise of Q things. We actually talk about, I think that the term grifter really, it sort of, it trivializes his involvement. It's like, yeah, you can just make money off of it. That does seem to be one thing to me, but the term that I prefer to use there is actually ethnic entrepreneur. Because it is, you see this throughout history of people who are like, yeah, the money's there. The money's great. Doesn't hurt, obviously, especially when you owe $5 million in legal bills. Sure. But I do think that the biggest thing for him is that it was this information op. It was able to muddy the waters and create a lot of confusion regarding what is true, what's fact, what's not, and just what's up from down, basically, and in supporting Trump. And then I think eventually, is creating this new American system the way that he sees it, the sort of dominionist fantasy of this system that he wants to create. And so season one, we culminate in January 6th. In fact, we were supposed to, the show was supposed to air January 8th, and we did not cut a final act of the third episode because we were like, nope, whatever happens on that day is what this needs to be. Right. Like it, the language in Q world was very clear that something was going to happen on January 6th. And so we held off, and the night before, you see Flynn giving this speech to them where it's almost a general, you know, directing his troops or rallying his troops the night before battle. And so we left off there, and this season we pick up with exactly 1 year after the insurrection. What has happened to these 30 million people that we have assessed fully believing QAnon in the United States. And, you know, we thought that it might be different this season. We get to do something different, but pretty right away, basically we're landed at the doorstep of Mike Flynn again. Just can't get rid of that guy.
Sorry. God, I'm absolutely fascinated. Just before getting onto that part of the story, I was really struck by your, I'm going to seize this phrase for ethnic entrepreneur. I want to see if there's any other ethnic entrepreneurs that you pick up on, for example. I don't know. Maybe Roger Stone, for example. Maybe Steve Bannon. Heaven help us using grifter as a phrase for him, despite the fact, of course, that he is absolutely nailed on the case of the mythical millions for the wall that were raised. Absolutely. I mean, are Bannon, Stone, anyone else, as it were, in Trump world who are outside the White House, as Bannon was from 2017, do they have connections with Flynn and thus indirectly with Q, or do they steer clear of this?
No, usually connected. His relationship with Bannon, I haven't really been able to figure out. It doesn't appear that they like each other, but I think they tolerate each other. That's total speculation, though, right? I don't know either one of those gentlemen personally, but I do think that, you know, they certainly push each other's things. And for example, Bannon and Flynn thing I would point to the most is that they have been the two most instrumental figures in this election cycle, pushing these local or election deniers to run for local office. And you almost can see that as like part of a political insurgency, right? So I think that, you know, Bannon's good at it from the political strategy standpoint, political science standpoint, and Flynn knows how to run that like a military operation, right? He's from all of his years of focusing on counterinsurgency, obviously they're kind of one and the same. It's time to, that line gets blurred at some point. So big connections between Bannon and Flynn on a lot of the things they're pushing. And Bannon's definitely a hero within Q world. And then Roger Stone is very, very active in the Q world in a big way. I think that, you know, Bannon's just never met like a radicalization campaign or grift, or Roger Stone has never met a radicalization campaign or grift he didn't like, you know? And so I think that in, he's certainly one of the early validators of Q. He's pushing a lot of information right before Q actually starts. He starts saying stuff about pedophilia, and Mike Flynn knows where the bodies are buried and things that we'll later hear echoed in Q drops. And then now this tour that Mike Flynn is on, this Christian nationalist political rally that he's on around the country, Reawaken America. Roger Stone speaks at that. And he's just really, really deeply connected to a lot of the figures that we see as part of this sort of Q 2.0 movement that have risen out of Mike Flynn's Reawaken tour.
Well, Marley, can I ask you, let me ask you what, I don't know if it's a jackpot question or not, before we get into season two, which I want to find out more about, but there's in December of 2020. So just a few weeks before January 6th, Mike Flynn is at the White House. I think Patrick Byrne is there. The Overstock.com guy is there. There are Trump's lawyers or pretend lawyers, people like Sidney Powell that are there. It's an infamous meeting the way it's been portrayed. But there's one thing that comes out of it, and I want to play connect the dots with you to see if it matches up with what you found out. And that is one of the takeaway lines from it is that Flynn tells Donald Trump, you can declare martial law. You can declare martial law, call out the troops, and hold on to office. Now, some of the media, in a sense, sort of just took that episode in isolation, right? And it's just sort of hung out there. It just so happened, I was doing research on a project this week, and I had forgotten this, but I think in September 2020, Roger Stone, before the election, had said, if it doesn't turn out right, Trump can invoke martial law.
Really? I've never seen that. That's great.
Yeah. So you've got Flynn in 2020, and you got Stone in December. You got Stone in September. The part you know about with Flynn, are we really talking about, in a sense, that Flynn is trying to use the election almost, in a sense, as his catalyst to invoke what is a long-running project, which is that, you know, Q has called for this, Flynn's called for this, we're going to take over the American system. Does it go as far as that when in that meeting?
I think so. I've spent a lot of time on that meeting, and actually spent a lot of time with Patrick Byrne. This season I spent, I was not able, I've spent years trying to get to Mike Flynn, and the closest we got this year was Patrick Byrne, and he was a fascinating figure, and we ended up spending quite a bit of time with him. I traveled with him a little bit. I was with him when he went to testify before the January 6th committee. And so I've spent quite a bit of time on this meeting with him and in my own research. And I will clarify that all accounts of that meeting, Flynn is calling for martial law in interviews before and after the meeting. As I understand it, it was more that he wanted the military to go rerun the election. He wanted to use the National Guard to go rerun the election there. And as I understand it, was not actually pushing the term martial law in the meeting itself. Of course, I wasn't there. But essentially sort of all the same thing, right? And I do. I think that that meeting really, you know, within an hour of it ending, we see Donald Trump send up this, you know, insurgent bat signal, basically, of this tweet that where he says, you know, come on January 6th, we'll be wild. This is the first indication we have of January 6th coming from the White House. And that's an hour after that meeting ends. I think that it really does kick off everything that we've seen play out since. And I do think that this is sort of all of the above. I think it is part of this, you know, long-term play they had, as well as an immediate fix to their issue, which was if Donald Trump goes away, we get further from our goals here, and also pretty good chance some of us go to jail. So let's do everything we can to hold on to power while we've got it. And you know, the lawyers, the White House lawyers, Pat Cipollone and others, were pretty adamant that no, the election was not stolen. Yeah, Joe Biden actually just won. And you need to take these conspiracy theories and get out of here. Stop. And they present Donald Trump another option. I think that's the most important thing of this meeting, is that but for this meeting happening, Trump would kind of just be out of options. There's no one around him that could do anything about this, right? There was no one was playing into his fantasies. No one was playing this game with him. And he found people to play with. And in fact, to hear Patrick Byrne tell it, he says the direct quote is, put us in, coach, we'll win this for you. So we talked to him very extensively about that meeting, and get a really fascinating firsthand account of that meeting from Patrick in the show. But I think that, yeah, it's a pivotal meeting. It really can't be understated how important that night was.
Wow.
As far as I remember, Trump's first real reference to QAnon was summer of 2020, when he's asked about it at a press conference. And he uses that standard quote. He used it on after January 6th about good people, about patriots. So do you have the sense that Trump, either before or by the time of that meeting in December, knew of Flynn's connections with QAnon, that he had any sense of anything wider, or was it just simply whatever keeps me in power, fair game?
It's a little bit of both. I mean, I feel like if he knew anything about QAnon, he knew Mike Flynn was somewhere in there, right? My personal theory on it, everyone has different takes on this, and my personal theory is that they had kind of kept Trump out of QAnon because they were like, let us run this, like, we got this. And he probably knew they were doing some sort of information op and, you know, heard through Roger or something. But if I had to guess, and I do, I guess, is he didn't fully understand what Q was. He just saw it as like another group of people who were, you know, rapidly obsessed with him, which is all mattered to him. He didn't ask a lot of questions beyond that, probably.
Yeah.
Right?
It's like, oh, are they coming? Yeah, because he wouldn't allow either it was because he wanted to make money off the marketing, but he would not allow or someone in his administration or group or campaign wouldn't allow Q people to wear their t-shirts. I remember at a certain point. And then it changed. And I remember this because I think there were people who were trying to show up to the rallies and everything. They had their Q t-shirts on, trying to get his attention. And then all of a sudden they said, no, they couldn't wear them anymore. So at a certain point he was on board, or at least he knew, but it was just something
I certainly don't think that was a Trump call that they couldn't come in their Q t-shirts anymore. I think that was the FBI put out a bulletin, not labeling QAnon as a domestic terrorist group, but saying this certainly has domestic terrorist implications. Mm-hmm. And we are seeing a rise of violence, political violence, and interpersonal violence is really the scariest thing about QAnon to me, is that it's just really, really bizarre mass radicalization, families, mothers killing their children and things, which is really sad. But so I think that once the FBI came out with that bulletin, Treasury or Secret Service was like, all right, guys, let's stop letting the domestic terrorists into the rallies with their domestic terrorist suits on, right? And then I think people still did get in, but I know that does still stand. I met a guy at the first rally that Trump had after since he's left office, was in Arizona this year, and in Florence, Arizona. And I met a guy who tried to get in with a Q shirt and was told that he couldn't come in, and he was pretty upset about that. But the thing about Q is that they find ways to rationalize anything. Yeah. So it doesn't matter. Right.
Yeah. Yeah.
Deep state, keeping them out.
Yeah, yeah, exactly. The deep state, somebody in there.
Have you ever experienced turbulence on a flight and wondered why?
And you can see all the terrain around you. You've got no issue with visibility or anything?
No, everything's peachy.
Maybe you've sat on the tarmac for hours wondering why your plane isn't moving.
Well, we're outside here. They're saying the ramp is closed. They won't let us park because of Air Force One.
Listen in on the conversations between pilots and air traffic controllers on the Air Traffic Out of Control podcast.
5103, declaring an emergency. There's smoke in the cabin. I need to make a landing right now on 31 left.
We have the most interesting, wild, and funny ATC recordings you will ever hear. Check out Air Traffic Out of Control wherever you listen to your favorite podcasts.
In fact, when you touched on something of how this affects families, marriages, relationships, which I read a lot about in Coda Story, for example. They did a whole series, of people and their families, and how kids and their either partners, right, there were marriages that actually broke up. Even on Telegram, there were all sorts of chats of people, asking for help and advice on how to get their family member de-radicalized, because it was.
Yeah, there's a really great Reddit group that is it's called QAnon Casualties that deals specifically with that. It's for family members who have lost a family member to what is essentially a digital cult, right? And it's heartbreaking. I honestly like, of all of the really dark, sad things I've had to focus on for this show, QAnon Casualties gets me really big. It's really sad.
It is. Yeah, those stories are heartbreaking. Heartbreaking.
And it goes beyond just the like distancing. There's a huge amounts of violence that's coming out of this, right? There are so many QAnon connected. I mean, things like, blocking the Hoover Dam, things, big infrastructure things. But more importantly, I think there's been several examples of this, but there was a man in San Diego who took his kids down to Mexico and killed his two children last year, who believed that they maybe had a little bit of lizard blood in them from Q. They've been pushed. And this is happening all over the world. There have been several in the UK and France. It's been all over Europe. And this is something that is really taking hold, is this real terrible violence, murder, and QAnon connected crimes across the board. So we talked to a guy named Mike Jensen, who studies this for a living. He does a great job in the show. And he really unpacks a lot of these issues.
Okay. Yeah, we see a lot of it here as well. I mean, I ran into it because one of my friends sent me messages or something like that from on WhatsApp about the pedophiles and this is here in Italy. So this stuff travels, you know, real fast. Mm-hmm. What are the connections between the QAnon US and Russia? Like, how does Russia fit into all of this, Marley?
You know, I think that we talked about QAnon rising out of the disinformation campaigns that we saw take hold in 2016. And obviously, you know, so much that was Russia. That was hugely Russia. I was the producer on a film called Active Measures that unpacked that. And when I thought I was going into QAnon, I thought I was going to be going into a completely different world. But I was not. And, you know, you said earlier, Mo, that you found out about QAnon by your friend sending you this Fall of Cabal video and saying, what is this? And following that path, I actually found it. The German Marshall Fund had that great website that was Hamilton 68, which was looking at Russian. And so while I was making Active Measures, that came out. And the first time I saw QAnon was there, right? That was the thing being pushed by the IRA that morning. It was hashtag QAnon. It had been disseminated all across the board. Russian media was covering it. And I was like, what is that? What's QAnon? What is this? And that was the first time I found it. When all of the IRA accounts were taken down and released what they were pushing, many of the earliest, biggest, you know, amplifiers of Q narratives and just straight hashtag QAnon and pushing what was happening on the boards was the IRA, was the
Internet Research Agency.
Out of St. Petersburg, troll farms, you know, and I think that they were really responsible for allowing it to take hold because they had such a good system going with their trolls and with their networks, right? That they were able to really push it early. And then, you know, as we move on, I think Russia's kind of got their hands full right now. And so I do believe that while they're echoing each other in huge ways, they're continuing, you know, American Q crowds are pushing Russian narratives and, you know, the Kremlin spokespeople you see pushing Q type narratives, right?
Yeah.
But I think at this point there has been a separation, and I'm sure there is money trail there that I have personally not been able to track down, but I hope to at some point in my life. I hope federal investigators are looking at that in a big way. But the other thing is, I think that you see it with Q in Russia is that, like, you know, we mentioned Roger Stone, we mentioned Bannon, we mentioned Mike Flynn. It's pretty much across the board. All of the big characters in Q do have Russia connections.
And there's also mention here, for example, in the Q accounts, because I had gone through, you know, I had done my own research in the Italian Q world, and they use the exact same, you know, Patriot Front, all of that kind of thing, just translated, but sometimes not even translated. It's just completely in English. The big accounts. I mean, I can get into it, you know, maybe we'll talk about this, Scott, another time, but, and they're connected to a lot of the radical right parties that are here. These are all supporters. And that's what scares me also for the Italian election that is coming up, and which, you know, Scott and I will be talking to, somebody about that. But anyway, it's,
I'm worried about that for our election this coming up too.
Marley, with season two coming out, there's so many takeaways you've already given to us, which is, you know, the personal side of the story that shouldn't be lost, the effect on these people that are living with this, the ways that these narratives, as it were, well, they're never in control, but they spiral further. But you said something that was interesting earlier. You said you thought you would find, in effect, that it wasn't that Q had diminished as a force, I think, you know, that the last big drop was in December 2020. But then you said you didn't find that. You found it continues. if it's not continuing in that organized way through the drops, you know, to the millions of followers, where is the movement now? Is it still an organized movement with very clear objectives? Or is the force simply more of that psychological corrosive force that it continues to wear away at its members and indeed society just because the poison is still out there?
Yeah, I mean, that's really a great way of phrasing that. I mean, it's an important question and definitely what we sought to answer this season. For me, I think that, man, it in so many ways is more organized now and more alive than it ever was when it was on the boards. But it sort of has what's grown out of it, the offshoots of Q, we see this really rise through Stop the Steal movements, through COVID conspiracy, and you know, all of the anti-vax narratives, and as well as the continuing idea of the pedophilia and the Save Our Children narratives, right? So these three narratives that have taken hold, I think, far beyond the reach that Q had, continue to give life to this movement. And in many ways, they're more organized than Q ever was. This Reawaken America tour that Mike Flynn is doing, we see all three of those theories being really at the core of that. And while they're not posting and while they're not referencing Q anymore, and in fact have gone so far as to disavow Q in most cases, they are really, I mean, they're using the same exact language, right? They're not even changing the words. They're not changing anything about it. They're giving basically direct Q drops from the stage, things that I recognize as words that Q used, that these speakers are saying without saying Q's. They've lost the riddles. They've made it more accessible and they've been able to mainstream it in a way where they don't even need Q anymore. You know, this digital prophet is gone and new leaders will pop up and come about and it will continually evolve. But I think that they're in a place now where this has been, I mean, it has borne a new entire sector of the United and globally, really. I mean, an entire group of people who truly believe these things and don't need drops, don't need anything.
They have Telegram. Basically, they're going from what I saw, Marlene, was that they, let's say in the movement, the actual pipeline, the information that was traveling from one thing to another. There was, let's say, the actual Q stuff. So all of the anti-systemic narratives that we've seen in the United States, then COVID hit. So they all latched on to COVID. Then I was also following, for example, the truckers. Okay.
Big time.
Huge. And they're still at it. They have brought in the whole pedophilia. They brought in the COVID. They're still, you know, talking about the vax and how, you know, they're trying to control us and all of that kind of thing. And they're still believers. They're absolute believers. I mean, I ran into one in Toronto and I was shocked. Okay. I was getting my hair done. And she's talking about how Trudeau is out just to control society and it's going to become a fascist state and he's a fascist. And this is the kind of language, right, that they're using. But we see this, okay, every day for that kind of thing. What's the next development? Do you see it going anywhere or developing further?
Yeah, I think that, you know, on the trucker thing, just briefly, so it starts in Canada and then there's the European protest that in the Netherlands really took off there.
Yeah.
My cinematographer for this season has done an incredible job of covering it. He's been all over the world covering it and did wonderful footage. But the takeoff of the United States one was out of California. And I went to the first night of the trucker rally as people came together before they started their journey, before any of the things, and, you know, got there and, you know, the events funded by the America Project, which is Mike Flynn's organization, right? And I think that in many ways, it's like he's pulling these different strands. We look at sort of the Christian nationalist side that has grown out of this, as well as the militia movements that have grown out of this. And I think that what's important here is that they have a diversified, essentially, you know, the troops, right? They need truckers for something and they can call in the truckers.
Yeah.
They need, you know,
yes,
women who are going to go and attack school boards, they can call them. And there's all of these different sort of flavors that they can pull from, but it's all part of the same thing. And I think that we'll continue to see them pop up. I think the biggest thing we're going to see next with them is what's going to happen in the midterms coming up. I'm pretty nervous, I think we're seeing a lot of the election deniers who are very close with the Q world and speaking at a lot of these events that I'm at are, you know, we've seen Mark Fincham become the nominee Secretary of State in Arizona. That's terrifying. And we've got one, Jim Marchant in Nevada and the Michigan nominee. All of these people are super connected. I think that's where they're putting their main effort. And I think we're going to continue to see election officials specifically, those roles targeted by QAnon conspiracy theories and the people who believe them, as well as the funds and such by Mike Flynn, Patrick Byrne, others who are leaders of this movement. And I think that it sort of depends on what happens in the midterm, what their next move is, because they've really built this system where they can pull in anything now, right? If it goes this way, we've got a plan. If it goes this way, we've got a plan. And they can really, I think continue to evolve and I guess eventually take over. I don't know.
You know what it reminds me of? It's sort of like they've weaponized so many aspects of society. So they can go anywhere. They can go towards the military route. They can go towards health, education. I mean, it reminds me a lot of Russia in that way, because Russia just weaponizes every single thing that they can get their hands on, including toys, literature, whatever. So I can see that, and you'll have little cells, which is really disturbing.
Cells, right.
That'll be the, they've created sort of like terrorist cells, right?
Yeah, Marley, basically that. The other thing I would just say real quick on the Russia thing. Sorry, Scott, I'm sorry to interrupt you. I was just going to say, in weaponizing everything, we think of this as a far right movement. Mm-hmm. But it has been super effective on the far left here too. And I think this is the first American movement that we've seen really do that in a way that Russia has been doing for a long time.
Yeah.
And it's something that's not acknowledged very much in the media. And it's constantly like, oh, this fringe alt-right thing. And it's a lot of far left in the mix here too.
Yeah.
Without naming any names, like maybe the gray zone. Marley, I'd like to get first on when season 2 comes out. Will you come back and talk to us? Because I want to follow up.
Yeah, it comes out this Wednesday night.
Oh,
this Wednesday.
Wednesday, August 24th on Vice TV. It's 10 p.m. Eastern. And then it will come out. It's a 4-part docuseries, and it will come out every Wednesday following that for the next month.
Yeah.
So
if you haven't, and if you haven't caught season 1, go and watch it. Okay, so that way you're all cut up.
Absolutely.
Go catch up. And then I think that, I'd love to come back and hear what you guys think about it.
That's right. Absolutely. That's right. Okay. All right, everybody.
Really appreciate you guys. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Bye, everybody.